got a crazy ass true story to tell. It could be funny or thrilling or creepy as hell. And when you speak, surely none will make a sound. And the world's going breathless when your true story comes around.
All right, welcome back to Your Best True Story, where you are the story if you want to be, and if you don't want to be, you don't have to call in, but we're looking for more calls if you got them. So, Freddie, are you ready for five new calls?
Five? Oh, I'm excited. That's a lot. Let's go.
There's some interesting calls this week. There's a lot of spiritual-centered calls, like kind of questioning the nature of reality, which doesn't take much to get us talking about that anyway, so it should be good.
Yep.
And one thing, even though this isn't a show about current events, I wanted to bring up something that has story this week just to see if you'd heard about it that I thought was wildly entertaining. If you heard anything about the Ryan Garcia Devin Haney fight?
I did see some of his pre-fight antics with that fight, and I heard some commentary from some YouTubers on their thoughts on his the way he set himself up as a character going into that fight.
It was like I got intrigued by it like a week or two before the fight, and so I was listening to some of his interviews in real time. And for anybody that for the audience, that if you haven't paid attention to this, so is it Devin Haney or Devin Hart? I think it's Devin Haney was lightweight boxing champ for at least a couple of the belts or something. And Ryan Garcia is kind of upstart fighter that 24-year-old kid that is extremely talented, articulate, polished, golden boy athlete, like in all of his years leading up to this, like whenever he's in an interview or anything, he's super intelligent and articulate in the way he speaks. And then a couple of weeks before the fight, or maybe even a month, he starts showing up to interviews like kind of rambling, not making as much sense. He looks a little bit kind of rough around the edges. He even starts doing the snorting thing with his nose during interviews that makes people speculate he's on cocaine and he's been seen out like a Miami nightlife and everything leading up to the fight. And then he even misses weight the day before the fight, so which is a horrible
sign. Didn't
he
have a bet about missing the weight?
No, he had a bet on that's what the probable story is at this point, and he's even kind of admitted after the fight. So the way it plays out is everybody thinks, and he was also on interviews like saying some very wild things like about like, you know, the Illuminati and
Bohemian Grove,
he
got held down and had to watch kids get raped, and he went down some rabbit holes.
So basically
he also predicted an earthquake on June the 6th in, I want to say California, but I could be wrong. Maybe Oregon. I'll have to look that part up, but definitely his predicted a big, huge earthquake for June the 6th.
Wow. Well, we'll see if that comes true because the guy knows what he's doing because the whole point of the story is it's absolutely hysterical. He apparently trolled the entire world in order to put a $2 million bet on himself to win the fight. And he goes in and he beats the shit out of Devin Haney. It was like he knocked him down four times. It went the distance. And
so he got the odds makers
to bet against
him. To put
him
as an underdog.
Yeah, way underdog.
And then the betting public to do the same, kind of to push up the underdog number.
He bet
and then
$2 million
bet
on himself.
Yeah.
And won like $14 million.
Sweet.
And it's like, holy crap, that takes some balls. And that is hysterical that he basically manipulated the entire sports and betting world to his advantage. That's the kind of athlete you can get behind. That's the he is going to be entertaining for years to come.
If it's entertainment, he is definitely entertaining you.
Yeah. And that reminded me of another story, which I think is hysterical. And do you remember, I'm a huge college football fan, and back in 2012, Alabama played Notre Dame in the national championship.
Yeah.
And that was the year when Notre Dame was going into the national championship that Manti Te'o was their linebacker.
Oh, the invisible girlfriend.
Yeah. Well, today's the date when Manti Te'o's invisible girlfriend died.
She died?
No, well, that was the hysterical part of the whole thing is ESPN. So for people not familiar with it, Manti Te'o, linebacker for Notre Dame, had, you know how all like big sports events, they like to do player, you know, stories around individuals, especially if they've overcome like big personal challenges or heartbreaks or stuff. And so a lot of the stations focused on Manti Te'o's dead girlfriend that had just died from cancer leading up to the national championship game. And so the entire country is just like feeling so bad for the kid and like thinks like this is so tragic. And then it turns out later that he had gotten entirely catfished. The girl never existed. It's just some in San Diego.
Stepped in halfway through that. I didn't realize the first part about them, you know, being sad about his girlfriend having cancer and dying. I stepped in at where, like, hey, he has this girlfriend, but she probably doesn't really exist. So it was sort of a mental health thing when I stepped in.
It was led up to, like, before anyone found out.
Yeah.
That before he knew he had been catfished, like, he believed he had a girlfriend that had died.
So he was never in on it, is what you're saying.
No, he was never
in on it. Not like Ryan.
No, Manti Te'o was completely the
composing
victim.
Composing the whole thing.
No.
He was just getting catfished. Because I remember him getting bullied at some point because of it.
Yeah, no, that was after, once it came out. That had been, because I can't remember how it came out, but it's just, it's hysterical how much everything in media and the world can get manipulated on just a few untrue things, which is part of like where I go with it.
How like naive do you have to be to even have a girlfriend that you've never met?
Freddie, are you paying attention to
pen pals? Like, you know,
there are people that knowingly have girlfriends that don't exist now, but there's like plenty of people like that get catfished and have like, that's a, like, there's millions of dollars a year that
I understand that with the whole romancing the 60-year-old lady thing with, you know, guy from some island somewhere who's just about to come over, but something happened and he needs money to fix that problem.
The only part of it that I think is unique is just in the fact that the whole world
team, you have access to a whole campus full of, you know, potential girlfriends.
He was very, very in love with his girlfriend that just,
I'm going back to the mental health.
Yeah.
You gotta go back there.
Well, if that's your standard for mental health, then that's not saying much for the entire country or the entire world, because the whole world's going crazier, which I do believe. But the funniest part about all that, though, is just the way everybody gets duped in the world so quickly when a few outlets start to promote something as truth, how quickly and easily it can get into the zeitgeist that is the truth.
Oh, yeah.
And
And then you add the telephone game to it.
Yeah.
Where, you know, somebody tells somebody and then they tell somebody and then the original story is not the original story that you hear by the fifth person down. And it just gets more grandiose and more extrapolated out. And
Yep. Well, not to spend too much time on current events, we'll get into the phone calls and just write. Before we play the first one, I did want to mention this is the last episode of April. So all of the, if you want to vote for your favorite story from April, that will start May 1st up on the website through the 7th, and vote for whatever story you think was the most entertaining. And whoever wins, we'll invite them on the show and the win $250, and then we'll invite them on the show for a longer interview to delve more into their story that they told and anything else interesting that happened to them. And so for the first story, Freddie, we're just going straight creepy.
Nice.
Interesting story.
Okay.
And it is from a woman named Charlotte, and she's in upstate New York, I believe, and this is her call that I just entitled The Snake.
Hey there, my name's Charlotte, and I wanted to call in my own true creepy story for you that occurred when I was 16. I'm from upstate New York, but I went to England for a summer when I was 16 to attend a girls' preparatory school. And the idea was you went there for a summer and took a couple of serious classes, but also did a lot of stuff like getting you ready for college and adult life, like dancing lessons, horseback riding, manners, and learning about the arts and music and stuff. And so it was a lot of fun, but the first few nights I was there, I had a really creepy thing occur, which is probably the strangest thing that's ever happened in my life, honestly. So the school was located on a big English manor that had a humongous old drafty English manor house that we all stayed in, all of the girls that were at the school. And there were almost enough rooms in the building so that each one of us, there were only about 30 girls staying there, and each one of us had their own rooms. I think there were a couple of people that had to double up, but I was one of the people that got my own room. And the first night I was there, nothing strange happened. I think it was the third night that I was woken up in the middle of the night with what I thought was a hissing noise, like a snake. And so I wake up about 3 a.m. I'm startled, but I don't see any snake, and I quickly convince myself it was just nerves of sleeping in a new place, and maybe I heard the pipes rattling or the heat coming on or something like that, or maybe it was a dream, so I fell back asleep. The second night, though, same time of night around 3 a.m., I was woken up again, definitely by the hissing noise, and it was loud enough, and I was sure enough that it wasn't a dream that I actually jumped out of bed and started looking for the snake. And once I couldn't find the snake or anything that would be making that hissing noise, I even started to wonder if one of the other girls, one of the students, was playing a prank on me. So I looked around for like a tiny speaker or something that could be projecting that hissing noise, even checking under the mattress, everywhere I could think of. I couldn't find anything. So I eventually convinced myself it must be nothing and went back to sleep again. The third night, same time, it happens again. And this time I think I feel something squirming below my back in the mattress. And this freaked me out enough that I jump out of the bed, run down the hall to the one adult that stayed with us, the proctor, and she came down to my room because I was so freaked out. She started to help search the room to make sure there wasn't a snake there. There wasn't one in my bed. Some of the girls started to come out of their rooms as well and hang around my door looking in, watching as we did this, so quickly, I started to realize I was going to get a reputation as being the crazy girl if I didn't sort of put an end to this. And so I decided to say, like, oh, I'm sorry, this was a bad nightmare that I had, and I started to brush it off so that everybody would go back to sleep. But once they had all gone back to sleep, then I snuck downstairs after about 30 minutes and went into the kitchen and got a big butcher's knife because I was sure I had not just had a dream or made up the noise and the movement I felt below my back. So I go to the mattress, I take the sheet off, and I actually slice into the mattress with the butcher's knife. And I was terrified, but I stuck my hand in expecting to find a snake in there. And I did. I touched what I thought was a snake and ripped my hand back out, fell back on the floor, and just kind of sat there with my heart beating, waiting for several minutes for the snake to move and come out of the mattress. It didn't. I waited like 15, 20 minutes. Nothing happened. So eventually, with the knife in my left hand, I sucked up my courage enough to stick my hand back in the mattress. And once I went in far enough and could feel the snake again, I realized it wasn't moving. So I grabbed it and pulled it out. And this is where it gets even weirder, because the snake was obviously long dead. It had, like, its eyes were all sunken and hollow into its head, and the body was kind of stiffer than it should be and dried out, even though it was a real snake at one time. And so I didn't understand what was going on, but I managed to sneak downstairs again, put the butcher's knife back, throw the snake out in the yard, and cover where I'd cut the mattress open up with the sheet again. And for the rest of the summer, nobody mentioned that again. And apparently even the housekeeping, nobody determined that I even noticed that I cut into the mattress. But my question is how did I hear and feel a dead snake moving in my mattress? And still to this day, I can't explain it. It must have been like the snake was contacting me from the grave so that somebody would get it back out in the woods or something. I don't know. Thank you very much, though. I really enjoy the show, and best of luck with it, and excited to hear everybody else's calls. Thank you.
So, there you go, Freddy classic snake ghost story.
This one took a twist for me, because I wasn't expecting there to be an actual snake at some point. That, because for me, when she started off, I'm like, and this has happened to me, and I do want people, now I have a subject I want people to call in about.
Nice.
I want people to call in with their sleepwalking stories, because I myself randomly sleepwalk, you know, since I was a kid. And I've woken up and seen animals and cats and things that, you know, your brain is just telling you is there. And you wake up in some part of the room. And I've woken up to, like, trying to get a cat out of the fan, you know, but...
Really?
Yeah, standing up on the bed and my hands, I'm putting them into the fan and go whack, 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 whack. And then, you know, you wake up, so, you know, but...
Huh.
You turn on the light. There's no cat.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that, you know.
But you're aware enough, like you could, like, while you were in the dream, you could see it.
No, I woke, like literally wake up, you know, from sleepwalking, but now you're in between the two positions. You're not awake, you're not asleep, but you're standing up and you're trying, in the dark, your brain's trying to process what you, so it's telling you it's seeing things.
Yeah.
You know, and so then sometimes it would have been a squirrel like running along the edge of the windowsill or something, and you look at it and then your brain just like makes the thing move.
Yeah.
And move along. And so, you know, after a couple of times like this, I would back away from it while keeping my eyes trained on it, because I'm going to get to the light switch and turn on the light, and the squirrel's going to be there.
Yeah.
Because I have not taken my eyes off of what I'm seeing. So every time I get to the light switch, you turn it on, and there's nothing there. I'm like, man, brain. But then, so I'm like, oh, that's what she's talking about with, she's just waking up from her dream state. She hasn't slept, walked, but she's been in a dream state, and she's hearing something, and then... But now we have a new twist, because there is an actual snake somehow in the bed, which now for me gives me a couple other questions. Is that like a voodoo ritual? Is that mattress used for some sort of ritual where it was placed in there by the manufacturer at the plant of it?
Yeah.
Like how the hell did a snake get in the mattress? In it some time when the snake, you know, went and then was like, oh, this is a good place to lay eggs. Let me get into this, you know, was there a tear somewhere? How did it get in there?
Yeah.
And then you have the whole, it's talking to you now.
Yeah.
You know, or its frequency on another dimension is still pissed that it's, you know, locked up in a mattress and it needs to convey that to somebody who's listening, which apparently was her.
Yeah. And that is interesting. Which it sort of implied she didn't say, but then it stopped once she took it out and threw it out in the right. woods.
Yeah.
So it sounds, and it made me interested. So I started to kind of search online for animal ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Because this made me think about, like, because I go back and forth on the whole thing about ghosts is, in one way, if you believe in a spiritual paradigm, then it makes sense there's ghosts. But then part of it, I'm always like, well, but what's the point of a ghost? Yeah. Like, why does it exist, even if it could? And then I saw on online on Reddit, somebody was bringing up a good point of, if ghosts are real, where are all the animal ghosts? And even brought up like the argument of dinosaurs or like, why don't you have just a random T-Rex ghost running through a library sometime if
that
they're real?
That is a good point. Yeah.
It is one thing that struck me, though, as I was trying to think about this, and this is sort of my idea of how ghosts make sense. Is that, all right, in Hinduism, I believe, mm-hmm. they do go into a very detailed explanation of each person or creature's identity. You basically have like three different soul layers
mm-hmm.
that they all have different names, but there's basically like it's sort of like the concept of higher and lower selves
yeah.
in Western terms, but it's like, so you've got an eternal soul
mm-hmm.
that when you die, obviously would go back to the source to deal with whatever, you know, go into that other place that's not this material world.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a soul or spirit that is more attached to this material world, which if I remember right, when I was reading about the Western term that I thought that it was kind of describing was more equivalent to your ego.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if you think about like, and ghosts in general, whenever you're a ghost story, it always mostly seems like they're sort of trapped in this material world, playing out some event over and over again
mm-hmm.
or need some resolution to something.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like where I think like maybe if ghosts exist, what the thing is your ego, your sense of self
yeah.
in this world
mm-hmm.
is defined and created as you're in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And your soul goes back to the source, to heaven, to the next plane, whatever you want to call it. But then where ghosts are, which could probably happen with higher intelligent creatures, animals that could have a sense of ego,
mm-hmm.
like they have some unplayed thing still being worked out here that their ego literally can't let go of. So it's like the real thing takes off, but you've got almost this pattern, energetic pattern.
Yeah,
that's still trapped here, trying
ripple.
To get the resolution. So the snake was like, "Get me the fuck out of this mattress and
like
back
an
in the woods."
Energetic ripple left over from the original.
Yeah,
that's just reverberating in its you know, to whatever trauma it's trying to get through or resolve.
And there's some I've heard also that there's a thing called this. What is it? I can't remember it's something to do with like that, where there is a theory that it's just like almost like an energetic like pattern
mm-hmm.
that is getting played over and over again is what I can't remember what the term of that is, but when I heard somebody describe it, they were attributing it to like almost like an imprint, like where you get places that are haunted.
Mm-hmm.
It's because somehow that place structurally gets imprinted with that and
right.
just replays it over and over again.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's as good of an explanation about a snake in bed having talks with this lady during her summer stay at girls' camp.
Of course, it could have been voodoo. Yeah,
but the voodoo thing, you know, what if that part of it was, you know, somebody in the mattress factory had some ulterior motives to...
You can't ever rule out voodoo.
Oh, I don't rule out anything.
And
out.
somebody down the line, yeah.
No, but I do want people with... I really personally want people with sleepwalking stories to call in and tell me the weirdest place you've woken up or found yourself after, you know, coming out of a sleepwalking episode.
That's a very good subject. And I was actually, it's funny because I was going to bring that up again of like us trying to think up an actual theme. Because we didn't get any. I asked for serial killers last week, and we haven't gotten a single serial killer. I'm a little disappointed.
They're kind of shifty.
They're just shy.
Pop their head out that easily.
But
if they do,
as a sub request, we'll throw it out.
Might not be able to talk about it.
No. If they do, I'm playing it. I'm definitely playing it.
No, I'm saying if they pop themselves up to you personally.
Yeah.
You might not be talking about anything anymore.
Definitely don't try and call me or talk to me personally. Just call in the story. But yeah, sleepwalking would be a great subject matter. And so as we move on to the second call, this is, I think, pretty interesting because it is universally relatable to, I would guess, almost every human on the planet that has ever lived. And so the subject matter of this call is, I'll just read, which is a poem that most people in the United States have to learn about at one point. And you'll probably remember Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken.
Oh, I thought you were going to say The Jabberwocky.
No. Well, that's good also.
Yeah, I like but, that.
No, the end of The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost is, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Which almost every, I think why that poem is so universally lasting is because almost everybody, even if you don't like have, like, I mean, it's impossible the way reality is structured to not think, I wonder if I'd gone down that path instead of this one, what would have happened? Or if I'd said that thing instead of this thing. And this next call is from a guy named Matt in Toronto that has, he's a member of a band called The Band from Planet X. And I'm going to actually put a link in the show notes if you want to check out their music. And he has got an interesting phone call from a story about their brush with greatness.
Nice.
Matt, take it away.
Hi there. This is Matt in Canada near Toronto. This is my best and totally true story. It's not scary or paranormal, but in a way it gets me thinking about alternate timelines and what might have been. I do have one bit of a paranormal story, and I'll call back with it sometime, but this is not it. But it does relate, though, to my paranormal-themed rock band. For more than half my life, I've been in a sort of science fiction-y, horror, cult movie-themed garagey surf punk band with my cousin and a friend, and at various times some other people. We're called The Band from Planet X. Not Planet X, the progressive metal band, but The Band from Planet X, the band you probably haven't heard of. We're getting at kind of like a schlocky Ed Wood movie title with our name. One prelude to my story, though, is, and maybe this is indicative of my story to come, it's that the band was initially a two-piece with just guitar and drums. When I joined, my cousin said, jokingly but not incorrectly, that by my joining on bass, I gave them a sort of credibility, because a lot of people find a two-piece band to be incomplete. The irony in all this is that within months of me joining and making the band a three-piece, the White Stripes got famous as a two-piece, playing music that was pretty darn similar to us. So our timing was just off. But to the bigger story. Back in the early 2000s, when I was probably 21 or 22, we got into the North by Northwest Festival in Toronto. Listeners might know of it or similar festivals. Basically, the premise is that hundreds of bands play at multiple venues downtown over a few days. Festival goers, they can buy admission to like one venue if you wanted to just take in one lineup. Or even better, you can buy a wristband. And with the wristband, you wander in and out of venues all over the downtown, going in and out of shows, seeing the bands that you want to see. the night before we were scheduled to play, there was a big headlining sort of show at a larger venue, and the main band was Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. Their first album had just come out. They sounded up our alley, so we went to the show as a fun sort of thing the night before our more stressful, anxiety-inducing experience of playing the festival ourselves. So we went to the show. It was good. It was psychedelic, kind of hypnotic, lots of dry ice. But there's one weird thing that happened kind of randomly. There was a dude in the crowd just standing right around us, and I totally recognized him. It was one of those things where I just couldn't quite place him. And then it really starts to bug you because you can't quite figure out who it is. So the three of us kind of talk about this. We have this similar sort of feeling. We went to different high schools. We were wondering if, like, was it from high school? Is it from university? Was it someone from around our town? But we still couldn't discern who this person was. And then you kind of get thinking, oh, am I going to offend this person? Like, are they going to come up to us and start talking and we're going to forget their name and it will just not go well? So that's kind of sticking with us through the concert. But the concert ends and we leave and we decide to go to a pita restaurant just down from the venue for a late night snack. We ordered, we got our stuff and sat down. And just then, as we start eating, that dude from the concert, the guy that I knew from somewhere and was kind of wary of running into and subsequently offending, that guy comes into the pita restaurant. And he was with a bit of an entourage of several other guys. And one of those other people I totally recognized, and everything just clicked. The guy I recognized in that moment was Billy Joe Armstrong, the front man of the band Green Day. And the dude from the concert that we couldn't quite place, we realized in that moment, was their bassist, Mike Dirnt. The drummer didn't seem to be with them that night, but they were clearly with some of their crew. They were in Toronto that same time as us because I think the next night they were playing the huge outdoor venue along the waterfront. But that's not even the main part of my story, trust me. Sure, my bandmates and I, we exchanged some glances as we found ourselves sharing a very small space with famous people. But what really threw us for a loop is that they sat down at the table beside us, so my back was to them, and they grab a free Toronto periodical that was just set out by the door of the restaurant, an independent arts magazine. And this magazine was basically serving as the guide to the music festival that we were in. And it had the full schedule, the locations, and the descriptions of all the bands that were playing. So we're kind of eavesdropping a little bit to these celebrities as they're eating just one table over from us. And then our heads totally flip when we hear them start to talk about our band. I guess they'd gotten to the page that we were featured on, and we hear our band's name coming up amongst the conversation that they're having, just coming from their lips. The band from Planet X, the band from Planet X. As crazy as this is, it kind of makes sense. We're a lot less poppy and polished than Green Day, but at the end of the day, you'd find that they must have grown up listening to and liking a lot of the bands that influenced us, like the Ramones and the Misfits and the Cramps and stuff like that. Bands mentioned in that little write-up about us in that free newspaper that they were reading. So there we were, a little bit starstruck, and then with those stars talking about us about 3 feet from us. And here's the thing. Now, we've matured and mellowed as we've gotten older, but especially back then, we tended to be pretty shy and quiet and certainly not overly talkative, even amongst ourselves. We joke about being very punctual people of German heritage who show up, we play, and then we head home. The social aspect of gigging is secondary. So all that being said, we hear Green Day talking about us. Our eyes grow as big as saucers, and we ultimately do nothing about it. And truth be told, especially as idealist 20-somethings back then, there was probably an element of artistic smugness on our part, like we were underground, countercultural, while they were slick, polished pop punk, totally mainstream. And we didn't want to be associated with that. So we finish up our pitas, maybe give them a polite nod on our way out, as polite Canadians do, and we head back to our motel. The next night, we played our little club, and they played the massive outdoor auditorium on Lake Ontario. Since then, we've played, you know, the odd show and recorded several releases. But as we've gotten older and, you know, life becomes more focused on family and careers, or you just kind of get tired very easily and don't want to stay out late too much, the band has receded a bit into the background. I really like all our stuff, but we probably peaked in terms of production and tightness and presentation and fun around that time of that festival. I guess what I'm saying is that it's been a bit of a decline ever since then. I don't tell many people this story, but for a few years I ran a record store, and if there was a little kid that was buying a Green Day CD or record, I'd sometimes mention it to get their reaction. But sometimes, just on my own, I think back to this chance encounter, or non-encounter because of our aloofness, and I wonder if my life might have turned out substantially differently had we been social enough to say, hey, that band you're talking about right now, like, that's us. Let's stay in touch. Maybe we can work together sometime. Maybe I'd be living in Malibu right now, or Manhattan. Maybe I'd have gold records lining my walls. Maybe I would have married and divorced various cast members from the American Pie franchise. I mean, who knows what could have happened? Who knows what sort of alternate trajectory my life would have taken had I gotten my head out of my pita and just said, hi. But hey, life is still good. Life is great, actually. A few weeks ago, we played to a packed crowd, though the venue was tiny and probably only fit 30 or 35 people. But it was a heck of a lot of fun, and I'm thankful for all of it.
I really like that story just because it is so universally a conundrum of every human's life to basically wonder if you made the right call in different things. And it's just fascinating to kind of think of the implications of that.
Yeah, second guessing yourself at every moment.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, it's
the
just
big ones like that.
Yeah. And the only thing is, like, you can't when you're in the moment, you don't even, like, lots of times realize the potential. It's only as you get, like, the moment passes by, then you realize there was a moment there that you should have maybe done something differently. But it's, yeah, it's just all fascinating, the implications of that, I think, with
it is
fate, free will, like
in their situation, like when it's cleaned up and looked at from 2020 vision from behind, you know, it can seem so much more obvious. But, you know, if you play it back in your head, having all of the details, like there might not have been the right moment say something like,
yeah,
the like, yes, two of the band members could have been talking about the band, but the other one could have been ordering from the waitress. And, you know,
yeah,
like it couldn't have, it might not have been as clear cut, you know, as it seems once you wash away.
Well, no, well, that's what I think is so fascinating about it, is it's never clean cut.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. So it's not like, I think it's an error to ever look back and think like, oh, there was a definite right versus wrong.
No, I think your brain whitewashes the situation when you look back.
Well, it can do it either way. It can either say there wasn't an opportunity there or make it seem like you missed the greatest opportunity of your life. And neither one, I think is interesting, are exactly true.
Yeah.
You're constantly in a tapestry of choices that have huge ramifications probably that you're not. Yeah, your brain can't process, but it's just they keep on coming.
Yeah.
One after another.
No, that's what I'm saying. There would be things in that situation of that guy sitting at that table that his brain is taking into account.
Yep.
You know, that he might not even consciously be taking into account of the situation as it's processing things for him and giving him, you know, just the condensed Cliff Notes version of what's going on right now.
But that I think might be part of, because I sort of believe in reincarnation and the idea that your higher self or soul gets multiple games, lifetimes to play out to get better at stuff. And so it could be like that is those things that, like with him, Matt, maybe the next time he plays the game, he is not eating that pita.
Yeah.
He is going over, because that will be like an even deeper instinct gut in him that screams out, "No, motherfucker, put down the pita, go talk to Greed." And it might not work out. Maybe nothing changes.
Maybe he gets
still
punched in the face by their security guard.
Yeah, exactly.
He can't sing anymore.
Like, it could go worse.
There's so many different variations of that.
But I think that might be what like your instincts are when you have compulsions. Like, it's from the past times it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're just like overwhelming, like, I don't know why I got to do this, but I just got to do it.
Yeah.
And it could be that you trying the different scenario that didn't work out in the last time you played the game.
Yeah.
In the other lifetime.
I just don't want him to get stuck on that spot.
Now, I knew you would focus on that, but I don't think it's always when people look back on that it's a negative.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he's sad right now.
Okay,
Fred.
Good. And please don't be sad.
It's just interesting.
The name of his band was interesting to me too, because when he said that, I just thought of Planet Nibiru, but he didn't bring that up. So maybe wasn't. He did a pretty good explanation of where they got the band name with. So I'll go with his explanation, because they came up with the name.
Oh, don't let that stop you. Tell him what his band name's about.
Well, you know, he might in some other reincarnation have something to do with the Anunnaki and this, you know, Planet X that visits our planet every, you know, couple thousand years. And maybe that's why he subconsciously named the band that.
Well, maybe if Matt calls back in to tell us the paranormal story, which I'd definitely love to hear, maybe he'll answer.
Well, I want to know
if
he's even aware of that other relationship.
He did mention Ed Wood, which I don't know if you know. Ed Wood was like a schlocky B movie director that I think back in the 1950s or 60s, I think, that made some hilariously bad science fiction movies. I think one of his was either The Woman from Planet X or The Blob from Planet X. That, I think that's a play like he mentioned on one of Ed Wood's films.
All right.
Yeah. But the story also made me think about, which I was going to ask you if you had any stories. It reminds me of a couple of brushes I've had with super famous people that it kind of like makes you think. In mine, it wasn't like a substantial thing where I wish I would have done, but it was just kind of funny. It made me think back like one time when the first bartending job I ever had was in the Bozeman Airport in Montana, which you can imagine is as dead as it sounds. Nobody's going to the Bozeman Airport to drink, except when flights would come in, because it's a big like resort area, or you can get to Big Sky and like there's lots of beautiful country around there. So you would have occasionally mass swarms of people come into the bar, like when a flight got delayed.
Yeah.
Or so it'd be either no one there, crickets, or it would be slammed. And I remember one time just completely got slammed. I'm in the weeds making drinks, and all of a sudden I hear, psst, psst, hey. And I sort of vaguely through the noise, I'm like, that voice sounds familiar. So at first I'm turning around thinking it's somebody I know, and it's Michael Keaton, Batman, is leaning over the counter at me. He's like, "Hey, buddy, can you get me a screwdriver?" So I made a screwdriver for the original Batman, and he tipped me $1. I was expecting him to give me like $50,000. Like, that was the here, kid. But no, it was just a buck.
Well,
but,
at least
he was
paid.
He was very cool.
At least he paid.
He was very cool.
Lots of stories where the celebrities are just like, "It's me, dude. Yeah. See ya."
Oh, no. He was very polite, very nice, very came across as a very normal guy. And the other event that happened close to that same time frame that made me think of was, so a buddy of mine, like this is, I want to say mid 90s, I guess, had gone to LA to work in the film industry. He got a job on the movie, working on the production crew for the movie Armageddon that had Bruce Willis, Liv Tyler, Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I like that movie.
And big deal at the time when it came out. So he invites me to come out to LA for the wrap party, which is like once all the shooting gets done, then everybody, the whole crew and cast and everything typically goes and gets drunk somewhere and celebrates that their work is over on it. And so I go out there and the big stars like Bruce Willis didn't show up. Ben Affleck didn't show up. Liv Tyler didn't show up. Like the big three didn't show up that night, but pretty much everybody else in the movie, including Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer was there, and Michael Bay, the director, which I pissed right next to Michael Bay, and he was extremely loud and came off as very arrogant talking about how great his movie was to everyone. But then the other, the funnier brush with somebody was actually with Jerry Bruckheimer. So me and my buddy Luke are getting drunk and we're talking to people. Oh, the big actor, the huge black guy Duncan, I can't remember. He was there.
The one from Green Mile?
Yeah. He was there. Owen Wilson was there, which I believe Owen Wilson was laughing at me for wearing a turtleneck at one point.
You chose,
I don't know. I was trying to look classy. Owen Wilson was the only one that realized I was like a douche for purposely trying to.
Did you have a really long cigarette holder
to
go with your turtleneck? No, I'm thinking like who's the guy that does the Campbell's soup art?
Campbell's soup art. Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah. Andy Warhol?
Yeah, I thought you were going for an Andy Warhol, artist.
Hope to God I did not look too much like Andy Warhol. But I think Owen Wilson picked up on that I was trying to look more pretentious than I should have. But that wasn't even the story was that once we end up getting drunk, my buddy Luke dares me. There was an actress in the movie named Jessica Steen, I think, who... Basically, she's just in one scene. Like, she plays one of the astronauts that they're going to the moon. And, but attractive chick, definitely like established Hollywood actress. And my buddy Luke, dares me to go ask her out. And, and she's out on like close to the dance floor. And so I like go up to her, I ask her if she wants to dance. She's like, yeah, sure. And which I didn't expect. So me.
Now you're totally thrown off.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't plan for that. Yeah. So me in my turtleneck and this actress, Jessica Steen, are out dancing on the dance floor and don't even make it through one entire song before the producer, Jerry Bruckheimer, who is like extremely powerful in Hollywood, comes over, grabs her hand, and goes, Jessica, come on, we're leaving, and rips her away from me and takes off.
So tragedy. With her.
Yeah. And so I...
At least you got to dance.
Yeah, who knows what could have happened if Jerry Bruckheimer hadn't stolen my girl.
You were in.
Yeah.
You were all the way in.
It was probably the turtleneck. I don't know what Owen Wilson was laughing at.
No, I look damn that good. Sets you apart.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. I sat in like a Village Inn a couple tables away from Joey Fatone one time.
Wait, Joey Fatone?
I can't remember if he's NSYNC or Backstreet Boys. They both meshed together for me.
Oh.
But they were playing a concert.
Yeah, I never know. And, boy band people.
The bar staff goes to eat at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning and stuff, and their crew rolled in at the same time. Huh. That's my story of, you know, I ate back.
I had a girlfriend that I'm pretty sure slept with one of the members of Pearl Jam.
Pretty sure?
Yeah, just the way she talked about it.
Oh.
Yeah, I never confirmed that, but she knew him, and I kind of suspect that she banged him, but... Before we started dating.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was congratulations.
Just another brush with greatness.
You're just destined to be TV people.
Yep. So this story and that whole concept brings up some interesting to me ideas about fate versus free will and all of that. Mm-hmm. And like how much, but we haven't really got time to get too far into that.
No.
Since now, although just it might
come
up.
Do the thing you do. It's going to lead somewhere.
Yep. And now we are going to the third call, Manu from Sri Lanka, who is going to tell us about two stories that he had with close calls with car wrecks. And maybe if things had gone slightly differently, Manu would not even be here anymore.
Sri Lanka, nice.
Yep.
Hello, this is Manu. I got two stories about driving, and I'm going to win the $250 today on your show. So, the first story. I love American football. My whole life, I want to be a quarterback. It was a big deal in my city. Anytime someone got to come to America and played football, it happened twice, surprisingly. They never made a Pro Bowl, but they played some college, and it was very exciting. I looked up to these guys, and so I wanted to be a football player. So I was maybe 13, 14, and coming up on Halloween, and I got a hold of a football uniform to use as my costume. I had the helmet and the shoulder pads and the jersey for a local boy, and it was great. I looked so good in this. I could see myself being this quarterback. And I talked to my parents. They said, okay, you can go out with your older brother on Halloween. But I talked to my older brother. They say, you need to look out for Manu because he is still very small. And you can bring him with your friends, but we want you to be good. And my older brother said, okay. But of course, as soon as we leave the house, and I think he was dressed up as some kind of scary man, some kind of chiller or something. I think when we leave the house, of course, the tables turned. He started being mean to me like always. We had a very, very, very contentious relationship. We're better now, but back then it was very headbutting all the time. So he said, okay, you can come, but you go what I tell you, you do what I tell you, and you don't talk unless you need to talk. I said, okay, fine. Whatever gets me the candy, you know, I love candy too, football and candy. So he meets up with his buddy who could drive, and his buddy somehow, his dad got him an American Jeep, one of those beauties with a cloth top. So they took the top off so that we could go tearing around in this Jeep, me and my brother's friends. They stick me before we start driving. There's no more room in the seat, so they stick me in the way back behind the back seat in between that little back door that they put there on the Jeeps with the wheel on the outside. So they stick me. I was so small, I fit down there with my pads, and they shoved me down there, and then the rest of the kids pile into the front of the Jeep, and we go around asking for candy, which wasn't a big thing in my area at the time, but there were still some people who did it. So the trick was, since it was an American thing, the trick was to find the houses that had a little bit of decorations. Because if there was a religious house or the people were very straight about that, of course, there was nothing because they don't celebrate that. But at the time, and it's growing still, there were people who would celebrate, would put out a little gourd or something, some kind of vegetable with some decorations on the house, maybe just to let you know, okay, we're cool. We like to celebrate maybe a little of the holiday, but not everyone, because it was still very much frowned upon. So we know of a couple of neighborhoods that had good candy, good decorations, and we go driving. They had everything's going fine. We're having a good time, and I'm getting in and out of the back and getting a bag full of candy. And we say, okay, we're good. It's getting late. We're going to do one more. We're going to do one more neighborhood. We're going to fill up our bags all the way, and then we're going to go home and eat all the candy. And I said, great. So I'm having a good old time. They're shoving me in the back. We take off, and now we are driving faster. And going away, but the guy who has the Jeep, he's driving faster. We come up to a crossway, an intersection, and we have the pass. We're allowed to go, but the guy coming from the other side doesn't see us. So we're going through the intersection at 100 kilometers an hour. We're really, really, really going fast. And this guy's going the same speed. And he slams into us from the side. Big, big slam. Big T-bone. And I go flying. I fly out of the Jeep. I go through the air. And I go 20, 30 meters flying through the air. I hit on the asphalt. And I slide. I slide, I don't know how long, but I hit on my shoulder and I slide and I grind and I grind my shoulder pad all the way down to my skin, and then I stop. And I get up and there's a little bit of blood on my shoulder, but the shoulder pad is ground all the way down, and a little bit further I'd be able to see my bone. I promise. And my God, my helmet had a big flat angle on it from the grind, from grinding on the asphalt. If I didn't have that, my head would be jelly across the road. I would be dead and flat. I 20, 30 meters, I flew through the air and I hit with all that force on my shoulder and my head. If I hadn't loved football as much as I did, and if I hadn't decided to be a football player, if I had said, okay, maybe I'll be a killer like my brother and put the Gahotti mask on, I'd be dead. He was fine. He had the seatbelt on. The girl sitting next to him in the middle of the back seat, she did not have a seatbelt on. I think my brother said he wouldn't let me look at it, but I think he said they picked some of her braces out of the steering wheel. It was very bad. And that is the first story. And that is an incredible coincidence. And I let you decide what happened. If maybe, you know, there was something else at work, even though we were going about on Halloween asking for candy from non-religious houses. Maybe someone was looking out for me. I don't know. Maybe you can talk about it. Okay, the next story. Maybe not as big a deal as the first one, but still a big deal to me at the time. So I was young, driving around. I had my license at this point, driving around with a little four-door sedan, really tiny, but good for parking and all that stuff. I was on the highway, what you would call a back road, but I would call a highway in my around my area, and driving fast. No, not too many people around. A little bit of traffic, but I'm moving fine. And I'm losing myself in the music, having a good time driving, and I don't start to notice that the lane I'm in is starting to maybe get a little backed up. But we're still cruising, so I'm still fine. But the cars are getting a little closer together. And it happens. What happens next happens very quickly. I look up from what I was doing. I don't know why I looked down, probably to change the channel or the music station. And the car in front of me is stopped, completely stopped with no warning, no screeching tires or nothing. I slam on my brakes and I squeal to a stop just centimeters from his bumper. So I do okay. I stop just fine. But the guy behind me, he's driving a big truck with a bunch of equipment in the back, and he's towing a trailer, a bunch of work equipment, very heavy. He does not see me. He hits my trunk and everything goes dark. He comes up over the top of my car. I hear the squeals. There is a big boom in my face with the gunpowder smell from the airbag. And for a few moments, I think, okay, this is it. Manu, you are dead. There is no more Manu. And I slowly open my eyes and realize, this is not true. I am alive. I look up over my shoulder, and there's the bottom of the truck over my head. And it's dripping through it down onto my neck. That is how close it was. And so I manage to push open my door and I fall out onto the ground. I crawl away, stand up, dust myself off. I have some cuts, some bruises, but nothing too bad. Fortunately, a little cut on my forehead, that's about the worst of it. And I look at my car, and oh man, that truck pushed me into the car in front. It ended up being like a 10-car pileup. He pushed me into the front and crunched it like a tin can. Everything about my car was crushed except the little pod where I was driving. It was almost perfect. It was like there was a bubble or a force field around where I was sitting. And everything else, any passenger that would have been in the car with me would have been toast. They would have been smooshed. smooshed to bits. It would have been awful and gross. But it was just my spot that was fine. And so, that is another driving story. Another huge coincidence. Manu lucked out twice with the driving. I hope I don't need to luck out again, but I think it might be on my side unless I used it up. So what do you guys think? Do you guys think that is just a big coincidence twice in one life for one person? Or do you think there's something else at work? Anyway, I know my story is very exciting and I hope to get that money soon. Okay, bye.
I like Manu's confidence on the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
winning the vote.
he's already counting the money.
Yeah, apparently.
Wow. What a...
Those were a couple of close calls. Yeah.
Yeah. He's... I don't know. He kind of reminds me of guys that win the lottery like 2 and 3 and 4 times.
They yeah. Just
keep on managing to keep trucking.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the... Having the helmet on and the pads and stuff, the way he described that one, and that if he didn't, he would have, you know, been in the pavement. His head would have been ground down into the pavement. And then the second one where his only little space survived in his whole car, that guy's lucky.
Yeah. Well, it also, in conjunction, like, with what we were talking about with the last story, then... That's one way to look at it, but then like where my brain is kind of gone, probably because of our prior discussion with the last call, is then it does strike me that it's interesting how same thing of like looking back on your life to analyze better and worse choices.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting how people look back and can attribute things as either being lucky or unlucky.
Yeah.
And depending on the person you were talking to, it could, like he described the girl in the front seat that was picking her braces out of the steering wheel. Like
mm-hmm.
she could be describing that as the worst, the unluckiest day of her life. Who knows?
Like she survived?
Just, yeah. But I mean, it's just interesting, like how people attribute.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is subjective. Lucky. Yeah. Because if somebody else heard just you got in a car wreck, then they might think, that's extremely unlucky. But then the person that thinks I almost died but I survived, wow, I'm the luckiest person in the world. Yeah.
Man who's got a pretty optimistic, upbeat
yep.
perspective, which I think is going to take him, you know, places that he wants to go. That's a good yeah. outlook. I mean, you could go the other way and be like, I'm so unlucky that
yeah.
happened, but I like his version of it. I side with Manu on the optimism side.
Well, I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong. Like I'm just saying it's interesting
let's just do an experiment. So give him a right or wrong.
What do you mean?
I mean, judge him is right or wrong. Was he right or was he wrong?
That's my point. There's no way to judge if he's yeah. right or wrong. That's kind of my point. Is it just with anything is like that? There's no way to know if you were lucky, unlucky, truly in the way, and it's more about like your brain just processing.
No, I'm joking, but I mean for your own purposes, it's really what you decide it is. You know, if you decide it's lucky, it is lucky. If you decide it was horrible, then it is horrible.
Yeah.
And you move on from that perspective with that perspective.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But good for you, Manu. I'm rooting for you.
Yeah. Did you ever hear the story? What this reminded me of is when one of our buddies, when Bobby and a car full of us, when he drove into the house.
Oh, I have been told that story. Yeah. He missed a stop sign and missed the end of a road.
Yeah. Okay, I'll quickly summarize for the audience that so it was a bunch of our mutual friends were all packed into one guy, Bobby, who was driving his car. There were like 5 of us, and I think the car was like a Camaro or something. But we're already packed where it was like not comfortable and people like almost sitting on top of each other. And we'd been out drinking, coming back from the bar. And somehow the conversation gets going that there's a bet between Bobby and somebody else in the car of how fast he can get his car going. And so there's a big straightaway in one of the guy's neighborhoods that probably, I want to say, is like a quarter mile long with no stop signs or anything, that you could basically get the car up pretty fast to see if he could get over 100 miles an hour or whatever. And at the end of that road, there is one stop sign, and then there's a house with a big fence.
It's like a T, right?
Yeah, and it's a T
ending.
And on the other side of that is a house with a big fence. And we must have, Bobby must have driven that road back and forth like two or three times and just getting it over 100 miles an hour or whatever. But somehow that didn't satisfy people in the car, a bunch of drunk guys in the car.
He wasn't really trying.
Yeah, so we do it one last time, and this is going back in the direction of that stop sign with the house on the other side. And I remember, because I was squeezed into the back seat where I had like almost a perfect line of vision at Bobby as he was driving, and we're all getting up to like 100 miles an hour flying down this road, and it dawns on me, we just passed the place where Bobby normally would stop and stopped before, but I think he's concentrating on breaking a higher speed limit.
He's just looking down at the speedometer.
Yeah, but then at a certain point, like it was just funny. The thing that I remember from the event was how we all sort of collectively, like five drunk guys who had been whooping and hollering about stuff, we all kind of collectively realized we were about to die. And just everybody got real quiet and calm, and we were all just kind of looking around at each other, like with these puzzled looks and looking at Bobby, and Bobby was just driving straight towards the house, and we were all, it was just, everybody was just confused, like, Bobby, why are you driving us into the house? You know, no one screamed, no one said anything, and we just hit that house's wooden fence going, must have been 100 miles an hour, with no brakes or anything, and it was just like, Adam, I think he fell asleep. I think he fell asleep, or forgot he was the one driving. I don't know.
He was just so caught up in the euphoria of the,
because I swear experience. He never made a move where I could see him to stop, but it was just, so it was like an atom bomb hit that fence. It was just the car smashed into it. Then luckily on the other side, for the family, and I guess for us, there was either something like a ditch, like a decline, incline, like bump, and or maybe a bunch of tree root. There was something that we hit that caught, in addition to the big wooden fence that we plowed through, that turned the car from the house and brought us, ground us to a stop in the yard. And then it was just like pieces of the wooden fence, like airbags going off, the smell of gas everywhere, people's faces going into the, but to me, because I was sandwiched so tight in the back, nothing, I didn't even get a single bruise, but everybody around me was like moaning, and Dennis busted his chin open, and
so
then
did time slow down for you, like as you're careening towards the fence?
It got very, the two things that were interesting about it is time did slow down, but it was also interesting that nobody, there wasn't a single peep, there wasn't a single scream. It was just everybody just seemed to have this perplexed look, like, this is the way I'm going to die? This is stupid.
Sounds stupid.
And luckily, nobody was seriously injured. Nobody, I think Bobby had to pay that family quite a bit of money to repair their fence and yard. But yeah, it was, could have been a close call.
Oh, God. At least you made it out. At least everybody, you know,
I was
a little bit of monetary damage. I'm sure Bobby learned a lesson.
Yeah. And his car was totaled, I'm pretty sure. It was messed up, like the rims all bent in, and like, yeah, stuff was, all kinds of fluid squirting out of it.
Sounds like stupid game, stupid prizes.
Yeah exactly. Just one too many times going for the world record, speed record. All right, so call number four is from a woman named Joanna. Joanna in based in London, who is a, I believe she said her title is a quantum channeler.
Nice.
And I'll actually put a link to her website in the show notes as well. But she's got, apparently has some very interesting abilities that she's going to tell us about. And she would, I'm kind of crossing my fingers. I hope she might call back in and give us some more specific stories, because it sounds like she has seen a bunch of interesting things. And now here is Joanna with her story that I call Seen into the Matrix.
Hello, my name is Joanna of Mind Healing Guide. I'm a hypnotherapist, a medium, and a quantum code channeler. Now, the title quantum code channeler, that happened because of a really amazing, mind-blowing experience I had that I became a quantum code channeler. So here's my story. So on the date of December 21st, 2012, what the Mayan called the shift, or some people thought it was going to be like the end of the world or something. Now, on that day, I had no expectations. I mean, like zero, nothing. I don't know if I even at the time really believed anything would even happen. I stayed open-minded, but I'm a very healthy skeptic. So on that day, having no expectations, something actually did happen, which blew my mind, because having no expectations at all, around the time of about 10:19 at night, I was living at Denmark, Copenhagen, Denmark at the time, a frequency, like imagine like a tuning fork, somebody hit it and you hear it next to both of your ears. It was that loud. And my whole brain just vibrated. And it happened for about 2-3 minutes. And just mind you, there's no outside noises going on. It's a very quiet building, quiet neighborhood. And just side note, I wasn't doing any kind of drugs or drinking or mental capacities, fully normal, quote unquote, as you would call it. And I'm not on any medication, or was then. Anyways, so this frequency that occurred in, that I've heard, in my brain vibrated, happened for 2-3 minutes, and then it stopped. And the next thing I know, I see a green orb floating around my room. I didn't know what to think. I just thought it was bizarre. So the next thing I knew, like the next day or the same day, I wanted to see if there was like anything in the news, any music playing. I asked my neighbors if there's any, I don't know, gongs, being played or something, and nothing. So I guess, well, I kind of went about my day, because I was like, that was just weird, right? So about 5-6 months later after that, I started to see these like crystalline codes in around me, like basically the other dimensions. you could, just outside of my world, meaning anytime I looked in a light source, I'm usually outside, or anything has natural light, basically. So especially when I looked outside, it was all around. So these codes that I see is basically like crystal, and they're kind of looped like a snake, like a kundalini, like snake wrapped around, and it's see-through. And at the time, I had no idea what was going on. It's like imagine looking at something that doesn't belong in this reality. Like there was a Simpsons episode. I think that was the best example I can give, where he's like in, I think, the 2D. Don't quote me about what D he was in, like dimensions. He was in the 2D and he was seeing the 3D, I think. That's exactly what it felt like, because it, like these shapes doesn't belong in this dimension. They're like another dimension on top of each other. And it just blew my mind for weeks. I just kept saying, wow, I couldn't even really process it. So now these codes, they're crystalline. The reason why I say codes, because it's like a tapestry, basically, like looping and crisscrossing each other. And each of the intersection, there's a circle. And inside the circle is sacred geometry. At the time, I didn't know at all what it was, but I was like kind of searching everybody, writers, authors, groups. I was the only one who's, seen this like phenomenon or whatever was happening. And I eventually found a group that was seeing, and they called it the light codes. At the time, I just agreed. I'm like, okay, it's light codes, whatever, that meant. And then I had to do some more research to figure out what it is. And in, you know, fast forward in the future, actually, I realized that it wasn't just the light codes. It's actually our divine blueprint of our lives. Because I'm also a channeler. So during that time, you know, being a psychic and seeing spirits and ghosts and channeling information, you know, I can't deny what I see being a medium. I see the spirits. I see the other guides and energies that were there with me all the time explaining these things to me, because it took me a while to even process this. I mean, this is like, what, 11, 12 years ago now? So I fully process what it is. And it's basically, this is the divine blueprint of everybody's life. Everybody has this. And the reason why I'm seeing is because I was incarnated in this life to be a guide to others, to explain kind of the nature of reality. Like, our nature of reality is just layers of realities on top of each other. Like an onion, think of an onion, right? And it's all here on top of each other. Like the spiritual world, meaning ghosts and spirits, they're right here. There's the only reason why I can tune into them is because of my senses have evolved. That's it. And when other individual senses evolve as well, they're going to be able to see really amazing, phenomenal things, like, you know, including telepathy and different things. So I could just tune into different spirits and other phenomena that I can mention. Another story of mine, because I have so many of them. So, now, these blueprints of your life basically shows where you are in your life, because the thing is, we think about a certain amount of desires that we have. We want to call it manifestations, basically. You know, we manifest every single second. Our manifestations, we visualize a certain amount. It's not infinite. It's a certain amount and a given time. So when you focus on that energy of that creation you want to bring forth to you, it actually shows you in these codes, because to me, when I look at it, it shows me closer to me, and it's more visible than the other one that's there, but it's actually less visible and it's more behind. So I know which one I'm actually, it's closer to my creation actually coming to life and like in my reality, basically. So, and that's what I'm here to kind of explain to people, that we're creating our realities. And I think one of the most important things to remember, there's a destiny that we have and free will. Now, the destiny that we have is things that you signed up in this incarnation to go through, all the lessons, the good and the bad and everything in between, that's destiny. But the things that you do in between it, the way you respond, will create your life. The people, the places and things that actually will come forward into your life. And there's no judgment. It's all good because they only vibrate on what you believe and how you feel and what you think. So this is what I was told, basically. So these codes that I see, I've been seeing them, just side note, every single day of my life since that point onward. But I needed time to process it. And I've been mentioning on a few podcasts, and including this one. So I would love to share further information for this, because it's just like a little snippet of it, about this phenomena, and also other ones, like in another one I'll record about time travel, and that we, you know, these lights are photonic. Like, we are photonic. We're light. That's all we really, at core, science is going to understand that we're all light. You know, these crystalline light codes, photonic codes, are us, because at core we're light. And that's why, side note, time travel is possible, because we are light and the speed of light, clearly, right, is, you know, it's real. So I know I'm at 8 minutes now because I'm looking at the time, but that is my story. I'd love to talk further about it. And any questions you have, I'd love to answer. So thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
So there you go, Freddie. I think I haven't found out how much it costs, but I think I'm going to try and get your codes read.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah. Yes. It's such a awesome subject, which takes, for me at least, a lot of brain power to wrap my head around the concepts that she's talking about.
Yeah.
Like some of the, oh, so one of the kind of easier versions to palate and to understand as far as tuning into something, like, so imagine your radio, and all through the airwaves, there's all these different stations that are playing. And then they're playing all at the same time.
Yeah.
And depending on where you set your dial and which frequency you turn into or tune into is the one that you hear.
Yeah.
So if you kind of extrapolate that out, and, you know, you're the radio and your life is the music or the stations. So as you tune yourself into the version of that that you want to hear or see or experience, that's what you experience. And that was kind of a basic version of, you know, a really rudimentary Cliff Notes version, I think, of what she's talking about as far as manifesting.
Yeah.
But that all of the versions of it are here now for you.
Yeah.
Just which one are you picking? Which one are you tuning? Which one is your frequency tuned to?
Yeah.
It's hard to, and then the way that we experience linear time here is interesting to me, and the whole, you know, because if you can jump around and jump around between those points, and each point of the story has its own frequency that you can go back to, well, as we say it, back to or forward to, or just pinpoint to that frequency of that event. You know, how, for me, it's like, I want to know how the aging, you know, how are we linearly experiencing this at the same time as then you can travel to one of those spots, which I've heard you can do, you know, through projecting, astral projecting, or getting off of this dimension where we only see things the way we do.
Yeah. So with a lot of the stuff, and I just, the way my brain works is I always like do a lot of devil's advocate. Like I always think of the opposite side and different options. And so, not at all saying her specifically, but like with any of this stuff, I think the problem, which is both fascinating, but also what makes it so difficult, is that there is truth in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a lot of confusion, fluff stuff, even people grifting that is laid on top of that, and not at all saying implying her, but I just say in that all of this stuff is, it's fascinating, but then you don't know who is actually, who to actually believe. And I'll kind of give it like the, like I believe, for instance, that there's something real about astrology, and it makes sense to me on a big, like, if we're all interconnected and all, you know, even from physics, like, it makes sense to me that the planets could potentially be affecting life.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you think about in the terms of like destiny to some degree of who you are or the attributes of you, if you think all of the planets are affecting gravity and the physical world, then at the time you were conceived in the womb, all of those forces are acting on you as well, like they are the ocean or whatever. So it makes sense to me there's something real there, but then it becomes difficult because all of that is so hard to quantify and get actual evidence for. Then you've got some people that convince themselves they know about astrology when they don't. Mm-hmm. You've got people writing in newspapers over simplified versions of it just to be entertaining. You've got different. So with all this stuff, I mean, and I definitely think there's truth in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super hard to navigate the truth from all the potential the signal from the noise, so to speak.
See, I try and stay away from truth or not truth. I just try and listen to the story and understand the version of the story that somebody's telling.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Please tell me more about your version. I don't even, I just throw that to the side. I'm going to come up with my own idea of where I'm going to gravitate towards.
Yeah.
And so I just throw out truth and throw out lie, and I just have what's left, which is the story of this version being told. And, you know, if I want to find out more about it or pick it apart, you know, what am I going to learn?
Well, I mean, I think I'm doing the same thing. I'm not trying to say, to judge and say,
no.
Just, I'm just saying that's the way my brain works.
I have a hard time assigning the word truth to something eventually.
There's very few and far between
that.
Yeah.
You know, in any capacity, because I found that something down the line unravels something that you had assumed, you know, to be rock solid. Sure. And now if you've already assigned truth to it, which, you know, in my brain would be immovable, it is what it is, and there's no getting around that. Like, so if you've already assigned that to it, and then now something has chipped away at some of your foundation of a thing that you thought would never move, you know, where you left.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm not saying it. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's part of my process, is questioning everything from the other side.
Yeah. No, it's I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's my goal, is to not assign truth to many things.
I'd love to know what she means by crystalline, because I'm trying to imagine in my head what seeing something be crystalline, because I've heard in, you know, the quantum things where you get, as you move up through the dimensions, if I'm saying it correctly anyway, that your body will eventually turn crystalline with and be a light body. I can't comprehend what that means. And maybe, you know, if we are talking about different realities or dimensions, that there's going to be a hard time transferring it into something that's relatable in this dimension, you know, like
where you would have to think. Yeah. Yeah.
Like when you brought up one day, like, tell me a color that you've never seen.
Yeah.
You know, trying to describe that is kind of what they're trying to do here.
Yep.
You know, you just can't.
Well, and that's part of the problem. Again, I think with any of this stuff is there's a paradox at the core of all of it.
Yep.
Whether you're talking about from a spiritual perspective paradigm and that terminology, or a science perspective and throwing things like multiverses and different dimensions.
Yep.
The problem with all of it is you're the bug in the petri dish that can only describe things from the petri dish you're in.
Yes.
So you can't ever, all of our language, all of the things that we communicate with, the things that we tentatively do assume are real and can all kind of agree on as being real, all come from our empirical senses, which are all attached to this reality. Mm-hmm. So there's an inherent impossibility.
Bias. Well, there's a bias too.
Well, yeah, bias and a literal impossibility to... That's where, like, the whole debate, like, I personally believe in God in a spiritual realm, but I'm also very much aware that that will never be proven, because it can't be, based on what it would have to be, would have to be so much bigger than what this is, the material world, but we can only use these tools, these language. So it's like you can't ever, it's like the whole thing of an ant trying to describe an elephant. You're never going to be able to get the perspective as the ant to accurately describe the elephant to other ants. So it's just, so there's an inherent difficulty to all these subjects. And then, so you're just basically, so I don't know. It's fascinating to me that, like, that's not like a judgment that's right or wrong.
No.
It's just fascinating.
We're literally just left here to pontificate. And I think that might be the whole point of everything. If you are God, and then through dissemination, we are parts of, you know, but fractaled off so that we can experience as something, go through and expand consciousness through our own perspective, that you're never gonna, there's no end to it. So there is no period.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
The sentence keeps going.
Yeah.
And then like you know, some versions of our reality are like, we're in a simulation. We are AI. We're in a computer.
And that's what cracks me up, I think, at times, is when people say one of those different things with certainty.
Yeah.
Declaration. Because that's where I get like, well, how did you determine the simulation versus the Hindu version of Maya?
It's the same thing. If we're in a simulation, like, at what point do you just drop the word artificial?
Yeah,
like,
because, yeah, because it really, if it's a simulation you can't escape from and you can't alter, then the simulation is the same thing as reality.
Right.
They are indistinguishable. So it doesn't, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, using the term artificial implies that some, that was created somehow,
yeah,
and it's not organic.
Well, that's, yeah, and that's what cracks me up is when people get, and again, not, I'm not talking about her right now, I'm thinking about, like, people, like, more on the simulation theory, mm-hmm, like, where people are like, oh my god, scientists have just declared we're in a simulation. Like, what the fuck?
They did do that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's
this
like
week.
I mean, hey, I don't like... think any legit scientist is actually declaring that. But
I hope they are, because that'd be, yeah, make some good content.
Yeah, but it's just hysterical. It's like, no, you aren't. Like, even if you think you are, you aren't. Because if you had a grasp of, like, what you're talking about, you would realize you couldn't make that declaration. But I don't know. It's just all hysterical. That it does make me think, one thing I was going to bring up, because this kind of goes into our last call of, like, all right, so, and again, like, I think there's truth to all of this stuff, but then you got to sort of try to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Stop using the word truth for me, Jim. You're going to make me blow up over here.
I don't know what truth. I don't know. You're reading.
We just
you're,
determined there is no truth.
Yeah, but you're reading an absolutist version into
don't
by
make
truth.
Me fight you on
by
this
truth,
podcast.
By
Jim.
Truth, I mean more real, yeah, than some things, than the majority of things. But so I think there's some truth, Freddie, in all of it. But with the concept of manifestation, like, I believe definitely in a consciousness first universe. I think that is truth. I think that more than likely, from everything I've experienced and thought about and read, that the true substrate of reality, the closest we can explain, is consciousness. Everything does flow the material world out of the consciousness.
Okay.
The funny thing to me is when people get really caught up and start thinking about this for the first time, they get super hyped on the idea of manifesting things. They're making, you know, their vision boards showing cars and stuff, and mm-hmm, and thinking, and I've never seen any of those people actually manifest anything. And the where I would propose, mm-hmm, the separation from the more true version of manifestation from the getting misled version of manifestation is that it's possible, but what people forget is your entire, in order for you to believe,
mm-hmm,
you can't segment off parts of your reality. In order for you to truly believe, your entire life and reality has to be congruent to that belief. So you could be forming reality with your consciousness. But the problem, I'll use the example of Jesus in the Bible talking about anybody can do what I can do, mm-hmm, as long as you just believe.
Yeah.
The problem is most people so say that means you could fly if you believed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't show up and have a conversation and explain to your barber the next day how you flew,
mm-hmm,
and have that be congruent with everything else, like, in your, you're not going to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think people, the sort of the newspaper astrology version of the manifestation thing is people convincing people they can make wealth appear and they can make cars appear and all this stuff. And they end up buying courses and putting all their time into manifesting. And mm-hmm, there's some truth.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, if you cannot talk to everyone you interact with, if you cannot carry that same belief through all other iterations of your reality, then it's not going to happen. Because, mm-hmm, in your deepest parts of your mind, you don't actually believe. You're wishing, you're hoping that you get,
yeah,
the $1 million.
That.
But yeah, and that's
you
why
have to apply the same amount of belief as you sitting on a chair and you believing that it's going to, yeah, support you.
Yeah. And that's where, that, why most people can't be Jesus is because, or why most people, and this is where it leads into the next call, is probably the closest modern, like, this is why you have, like, mystics that go to caves and go into the, why they separate from the material world is to stop those entanglements so that they can create that higher reality. But like most people are not, that are buying courses on manifestation are not, do not have that self-discipline.
I will agree.
Do not have the courage to
that
do
that. Be, that there's been a commercialization and a, you know, of a lot of these topics down to a point where, you know, you get a package and send them $49.95
and
this will be all buttoned
up
for you.
Bunch of vision boards of Lamborghinis and Rolls Royces.
Like, rudimentary level, you know, we talk about light particles and where they're in a waveform, and then once viewed or once perceived, they collapse into, you know, a particle. Well, that's an interesting version of how maybe in this dimension, you know, things come about to be in a physical
form. And like, and that
with your
makes,
attention.
Yeah.
And that, then the focus of your attention creates the physical form.
But I guess where I would go with this is, like, because you've got to be congruent in everything, this is where it all comes back to then principles for an individual. An individual has to live. You've got to live the principles. You've got that when it doesn't result in outward cheers and approval necessarily, you've still got to live those principles that forms your actual reality in life.
Yeah.
And that's where it leads back to, more often than not, actual spiritual traditions that have that within the manifestation part they're talking about, but you've still got to do these things as well. You've got to be a good person. You've got to live by these rules. You've got to pray, because those are all the things that basically then create the congruence in all of your life to basically manifest the better things that you're wanting.
Let me ask you a question and see if you can answer this. Do babies manifest? Because at a baby level, you have removed so much of the stuff that you're talking about that you don't even have a concept of, you know, money. You don't have a concept of it. So do babies manifest?
I would say not at least in the way that the adult brain is thinking of manifestation. They possibly would in a non-ego, like, so, because basically I don't believe babies even have a sense of self. They have a soul, they have an identity, but they haven't been learned enough about the world. And this is why you have children that can remember past lives. And because they're not completely the ego part of them that is based on feedback in this world, establishing their identity to themselves hasn't developed. And so they might be manifesting, but they're not manifesting a car.
I think what you're saying, I think you locked the manifesting into the car and the money and the jewelry.
Yeah, well, that's, like, that's the negative part.
What I'm talking about is more of the creation of their reality. It to me would make sense that it's an inherent thing that you do every day, all day, every single day.
I absolutely agree that.
You have to, and then you get a perverted version of it where you're like, oh, let me get the Mercedes.
Yeah, no, that's what and that's the difference I'm trying to make is highlight is there is the real thing probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there would have to be. Yeah. There would have to. The babies would have to be able to.
Yeah, but I'm just saying. I'm just saying that. Yeah, we probably can't. The baby isn't what he's manifesting. Is not something as an adult that is going to make total sense to, because they're probably coming from a point of closer to the source. They're just manifesting love. They're just manifesting, like, they're not manifesting the concept.
We would have had to manifest our crib and our blankets and our, like, you know,
no,
some
I don't
things
think,
that we would be
I don't
aware
think
of, I mean,
I doubt
be
that
a baby.
No, because then you're starting to get into like, how do you know that that's not you manifesting?
Yeah,
that
no, I'm the, trying to think yeah. back. I don't have a lot of memories from when I was a baby.
I don't think there's babies manifesting.
But trips. They have to, though, no. at some point.
No, I don't.
Did they just exist in the ether until they're
getting,
adults?
I mean, no, I don't even know how you would be assigning who's manifesting what, because everybody's
of that we manifest our reality, the reality, like she's talking about where it gets formed and maybe from a waveform to
yes. But Freddy, I'll point out something that maybe if you think about, we'll answer your own question. All the cribs and all the babies are manifested by you then, right?
Right, technically.
So, yeah, technically. So, yeah, then,
so when I so was a baby.
That baby, well, then you.
So when I was a baby.
I guess you manifested
I
all.
I must have manifested a crib because I can manifest
I guess
now
you did.
Some pictures of the crib that I had manifested.
So
when
the
I was
answer
a baby.
Then, the answer is no. No babies are manifesting any cribs because you manifested
no other
everything.
Babies.
Yeah, other babies.
Yeah, no other babies.
Yeah, no other babies. Just you.
I hope she calls back because we have so many more questions about this topic. We're totally not done here.
No, that would be awesome if she would call in, especially with her time travel story.
This just opens up so many more questions.
Now the last call that we're getting close to.
I'm
going to
go ahead and manifest
time.
The last call for you.
Jim. Yeah. Let's do it. You're manifesting everything. I'm not even really here. So I wonder why you make me so contentious and combative with you, friend.
It's the spice that the audience loves.
But so the last call is a guy named Shiv from Nepal who was in the military for a long time. And he's got a YouTube channel that I'll link to in the show notes as well. But he was a commander in the military and then actually had a big spiritual awakening and has gone to stay with mystics in Nepal. And hopefully he's another one that I hope he calls back in and gives us more specific stories. But here's Shiv just kind of giving you an intro to his big spiritual journey. Shiv, take it away.
Hello, I'm Shiv Mathur. I would like to tell you about my spiritual journey, which started in 2015. I'm a retired naval officer in the rank of commander. I'm an electrical engineer. I did my engineering in 1989 from one of the premier engineering colleges in India. Presently, I'm 58 year old. My spiritual journey started 10 years back in somewhere around 2015. And before that also, there was some questioning happening. Self-inquiry, which I was going through, I was prepared. I was basically getting prepared to go into a deeper exploration in the spiritual dreams of this world. So in 2015, I had a very strong calling to go to Rishikesh. I was in Mumbai that time. I was working as an assistant vice president in Reliance Jio Telecom in Mumbai. It's a big telecom company in India, one of the largest telecom company presently. And I was looking after the network security of the company. So that was my portfolio and that was my professional life. I worked in the Navy for 16 years and corporate for 16 years and finally I'm retired now. My beginning of spiritual life is 10 years back. So I had a very strong calling while I was still working. That was just before joining Reliance Jio. I was working for Juniper Networks, which is an American company. And that's the time I had a very strong calling to go to Rishikesh. So I went to Rishikesh alone, and I stayed in an ashram. And this was my first spiritual travel. And I had a friend in Mumbai with whom I used to talk, have a daily discussion on spiritual things. So I was actually, my mind was already into this. And when I went to this Himalayas, so Himalayas is a heaven for spirituality. And if you really want to explore and see physically spirituality, if you go to Rishikesh, which is also called yoga capital of the world, you'll realize that you have come to a different world, which is full of spirituality. So that was it. And filled with yoga schools, meditation classes, Ayurveda, this and that. It's yogis and sadhus moving all over and the holy Ganges, divine Ganges, and the beautiful mountain. So the whole setup is so divine and so amazing that you get flowed and you get so mesmerized and you feel you are in a different world. So you very easily disconnect with the materialistic city life, this worldly life, and you are elevated. You are transported to a different plane actually. And then once you reach there, you will see things which you can't imagine. You don't see in day-to-day life the kind of things you see over there, the people you meet, the wisdom they have, the places which have some high vibrations. And all these places can transform. And there were some great yogis and there are some great yogis in the Himalayas. Some can be found, some cannot be found. So like in Rishikesh, some 50 years back, it was a forest. And there was hardly anyone in this area, which has become your capital. And there was a great yogi, and I came to know about him. He passed away in 1974, and his cave is close to Rishikesh. So I hunted for the cave, and I went to that cave, and I met his disciple of that yogi. So he himself now is 88 years old, and he lives in that cave during the daytime, and he goes down in the evening because there is no electricity. And he's now old and he's all alone. So he doesn't have disciples of his own. So he can't actually sustain in that cave. So that is a story why he doesn't live in the cave. So I went to that cave, met him. He was all alone and I had a very great conversation with him. And then I had some amazing experiences over there. I went into a state of bliss and my mind became empty. Without any thoughts, and I was glowing. So this is some experience which I had. I came back to the ashram and I started inquiring because I was not from the world of yoga and meditation, and I was trying to figure out what has happened. So that my very first visit led to a very big transformation, and this transformation completely changed me. It's changed me. It's changed my life. It's changed in many. Things started happening in my life which were more towards spiritual side, and I became a regular visitor to Rishikesh twice a year.
And that was when it was still only 5 minutes. I think he was going to continue to go on and tell us some individual stories, but cut him off. But okay. So hopefully he'll call back in with some more specific stories about what he has seen from the masters that he has been around and that stuff, because I have, that's where I think, like, if you want to actually see like the closest human ability to actually use things like the concepts of manifestation or breaking physical laws and things like that, it seems like there's a lot of legit stories that come out of India of people like doing pretty bizarrely amazing things that I think that like part of it is what I was talking about before, is I think a lot of those, not only is the culture already set up or not set up, but the culture is more supportive of those concepts than the US. So it's easier for people to keep it, the whole outlook of reality, more congruent. But then you get a lot of people like he was describing, not a lot, but some that actually go live in caves that separate themselves. And like, I've heard stories of people seeing people like levitating and actually manifesting objects.
I've seen, they've like mastered living, like, so they've lived like 250, 280 years old. So after looking at them for a little bit, I kind of, all right, this might be an unpopular or piss some people off position, but imagine, so you're playing a video game and let's say Pac-Man, and it's level one Pac-Man, and you got so good at level one Pac-Man, you've played it over and over and over, and you've beaten it every single way. Like, why would you come back to play level one Pac-Man again? And then yogis and the shamans are kind of like dicks. Like, they don't want to play anymore. Like, what are you doing here?
Yeah, I've actually wondered, that before.
Like, why did you come back?
For most spiritual traditions, they talk about, like, people that have reached that level coming back to be guides for humanity, to basically try to help. But then you do get certain
it's like
yogis and shamans that they aren't doing that.
They don't want to be here. They're like literally tuning everything out, including time and space.
But that could be that person was incarnated basically for this lifetime at the highest point that you could basically get.
Yeah.
In the regular Pac-Man game.
They
got to
eat the one dot that they didn't eat.
Well, but it's just like they quickly, like, by the time they're a teenager, they realize, oh, I get all this. This is my thousandth lifetime. Now I'm ready to move towards the eternal realm. So they just try to use that lifetime to do that. I think that's what you get with like a lot of hardcore Buddhist monks and things, is they just, it's not that they're purposely trying to turn their back on society. They're just trying to get rid of all the noise to finally like nail it as far as leaving this, because that is like in Buddhism, that's what they say, is like you've got to, once you obtain that, then you don't have to come back anymore. So it's sort of like they're on their last cycle and they're like, dang it, I'm going to nail it this time so I don't have to come back and live another life.
I'm taking the opposite approach, where I'm trying to enjoy the idiosyncrasies and the little tiny details, as opposed and juxtaposed to tuning out everything, small, big, you know, every breath, like, I don't want to, the guy's like, I don't want to breathe anymore.
It's different. I mean, it's different points the soul would be at. Yeah, because it's like you're the guy who is doing the opposite from you.
Yeah.
Is maybe he has lived 1,000 lifetimes more than you. He's already done your version multiple times.
Yeah.
And now he's like, I want to master this.
He's trapped here. Like, I feel like he doesn't want to be here.
Yeah, well, a lot of.
Like, so then I'm like, well, who's making you be here? Yeah. Like, what is that all
about? Well, now that's very interesting. Yeah, because there is, like, sort of, like, and I've thought about that, too, before, from the Buddhist beliefs. Buddhism is a lot about, like, their tenets is, like, renouncing all of the worldly pleasures and everything to obtain. But, like, yeah, that's, has always struck me as just, like, at a certain, like, why, like, why would you keep coming back to just try to get back out?
It seems torturous.
Yeah, it's like, there was an interesting, reminds me of something, an interesting theory I read about mummification with Egyptians and even some, like, I think South American cultures, like in Peru and everything, that have had mummification. Is the theory, what, like, so the conventional theory for a long time has been, like, they made mummies basically so that the king or the pharaoh or whoever would not die, not, like, we'd always have his remains, and that means, like, he's still powerful and all of that, and still here on this plane of existence. But then I heard somebody talking about the theory that the actual reason why they're mummified is because the pharaohs, the most powerful, knowledgeable people that did have understanding about reincarnation in the cycle of lives, like, that the next reality is so awesome that they did not want to come back. And if, and you basically can't reincarnate as long as you've got that remaining part of your physical body still here, it keeps your soul from reincarnating. They're basically like, I'm going to game the system.
It's a loophole, a cheat code.
Yep. and keep myself in the next world.
Cryogenics fall into that same?
Yeah, I would think so. And it's sort of a fascinating idea. Like, if you think like, okay, so your physical body is connected to your soul and is what roots you to this reality. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can't reincarnate until your physical body dissolves.
Mm.
And then, so you just, stick yourself in the freezer and you never have to come back.
Well, then, so why are these yogis living 280 years?
Maybe they
wouldn't they just like
maybe they haven't thought
walk
of that.
In front of a bus, yeah. like a bus as soon as they first chance yeah. they get, they're trying to like get out of here.
Yeah.
Like I can imagine you and your buddies like all get ready, you go to play laser tag, and then there's Chad, and Chad comes, and Chad has played laser tag so many times, and then Chad just goes and sits in the corner like staring at the ceiling. And like it's like come on, Chad.
Yeah.
Like, why did you even come with us?
Yeah.
Why did
Who
you,
knows?
Why did you even come, Chad?
Well, that brings up, the whole question, like, how much of your life you plan, if it's, like, in your ability to reincarnate, or maybe, like, the pharaohs, you got to trick the system into not spitting you back down.
Like, Chad's parents make him come.
Yeah.
To play laser tag, but like he's totally done.
Yeah, he feels like he's played laser tag a billion times and is over it.
But he can't not play laser tag, so he's just going to pout in the corner and stop breathing.
Which, just the mummification thing made me think of another thing that is fascinating. I'll just mention, have you ever heard of, I think it was Tibetan Buddhist monks that perfected this thing, of living mummies? This sounds like of all the worst choices to make in with your existence. Like, so they take it a step farther from the renunciation of all the worldly pleasures and everything else.
Yeah.
And vows of silence, all of that. So they're already not, but that's not enough for them.
Okay.
So, and they've got actual, like, this has been, like, there's documented and, like, they've found these living mummies before. So there was a process that once they had renounced everything for so long, which took years, that they would be spiritually pure and clean enough of the world that they could sort of start the process of turning into a living mummy. Where they would literally have other monks bury them in a box that I think it had like a little bell. There's a string that went out of the box and had a little bell that they would ring every morning if they were still alive. But there was leading up to getting buried in the box, there was like a 6-month period where they would eat progressively less and less. And there was some kind of special seed and tea they would drink. Supposedly,
how would they know it was morning?
I don't know. Good question. But basically, they would already have starved themselves where they're living off of like 1 calorie a day, and they were drinking some tea that's known in a high enough dose as like a poison that would basically start to somehow mummify your cells as you're alive.
Purpose?
Yeah, and they're doing this on purpose. And then they get buried in the box where they just meditate for sometimes, like, in one of the stories I heard, it like went on for weeks or months. The guy was alive in the box.
But he was ringing the bell?
Yeah, still ringing the bell every day and just meditating. So you're sitting in a box in the dark and all you're doing is breathing and not thinking all day.
Do they have an air hose?
Yeah, there's like one hole that the string runs out of to the bell that they can breathe out of. And then eventually they apparently turn into a mummy that still has some signs of life.
Sentient.
But like, but then their actual soul at that point apparently travels on. But it's sort of the same concept as the pharaohs, I think, that as long they believe that means then they've successfully
They consider
escaped.
That winning.
Yeah, they consider that a win.
Okay. And these are the leaders.
Yeah, those are the... That's the best we got.
So the best we could do is turn into a rock.
Turn into a rock in a very slow, painful process over months. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Boredom will really take its toll on you after millennia of lifetimes.
One of those guys, I'm pretty sure, then they took his because they pulled him out once he had stopped ringing the bell. And they pull him out and he's mummified.
Yep.
And in a lotus position praying.
Yep.
And then I'm pretty sure they encased him in gold. And now he's a statue somewhere in the Himalayas that you can go and like pray to him. And it's like the dude's actually in the statue.
Well, that's one of the ways, like, you know, I always thought it'd be cool. Like if I got at the end, I got cremated and then I got poured into molten metal and then you made a statue of me.
I'd like to make you into bullets and just shoot stuff.
Vile.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't you like that?
Be a golden statue of myself in some garden or on a beach somewhere where I could just be.
I'm going to lobby to get your remains and turn you into bullets.
Well, then it's on, Jim. You better hope you don't check out before I do.
Whoever claims the body can do whatever they want.
Fine.
Yeah.
fine.
Well, Freddie, we are almost at 2 hours here, so we'd better wrap it up.
Yep.
And don't want to overstay our welcome. And I would encourage sleepwalking stories is a great theme. We would love any and all stories, but definitely make Freddie happy.
Yeah, I need to know more. So any other perspectives of walking or finding yourself somewhere after you've slept walked and why and what? I just want to hear some other people's perspective on the act of sleepwalking.
Yeah.
There's got to be some people out there.
And I love like astral
projection,
lucid dreaming stories. Those are fascinating to figure out what's going on there. And hopefully we have more calls. Joanna, Shiv, anyone else, we'd definitely like to hear more of your spiritual stories. Those are fascinating and can make me and Freddie argue about truth for hours. So yes. Please call those.
Jim's going to label everything truth.
Or nothing. Depends on my mood. And before we go, please remember to give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you listen to. And to be honest, we know this show sucks. It doesn't deserve 5 stars. But think of it as a game, a prank we're playing on the entire world. You and us together. You can trick other people into listening to it. And then we can laugh at them.
It's like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah,
think of it as a pyramid scheme.
It's definitely a pyramid
scheme. Somebody sucked you in, you get to suck some other people in.
Like, have you ever eaten something horrible and your instinct is then to
smell this?
Yeah, smell this or eat this. It's just like that. Just leave a 5-star ranking. Tell your barber, your husband, your wife, they got to listen to it. And then when they do, just watch them and laugh and go, yeah, I'm sorry. I just had to share that. All right. Thank you very much. Don't forget to vote for your favorite story from April. That will be up on the website May 1st through the 7th. And call in your own story. And you can be a winner of $250 and interviewed on the show. Thanks a lot. Tune in next time.
Please be aware that your Best True Story podcast cannot attest to the validity of any story contained within. Additionally, all podcast hosts have failed numerous IQ tests and been legally deemed idiots by the judicial branch of the state of Florida. Therefore, please seek second opinions from licensed attorneys, doctors, CPAs, and/or ventriloquists prior to leaving your job to hunt Bigfoot, dragging a stake through your sleeping spouse's heart due to vampiric suspicion, snipping, slicing, dicing, or gargling any substance, attempting to drive your automobile off of the flat earth, or attempting to overthrow any government over suspicion that they are lizard aliens. The Your Best True Story podcast does not purport to offer legal, financial, or gynecological advice. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please wear your seatbelt at all times and keep your hands inside your own compartment. If there is a sudden loss of pressure, you do have our permission to scream. The Your Best True Story podcast takes no responsibility for divorce, bankruptcy, possession by an ancient demonic entity, or brain herpes. For everything else, we still take no responsibility, but we do feel very bad about it.
You got a crazy-ass true story to tell. It could be funny or thrilling or creepy as hell. And when when you speak, surely none will make a sound. And the world's going breathless when your true story comes around. Oh, hear the crazy bullshit flying. Just one more maybe true story before we're dying. Yet be warned, surely not all stories will be treated the same. So don't blame us if your tale about grandma's cookies is lame. The only way to ensure you could possibly win a buck is to make sure that story of yours don't suck. So instead of yawns, go ahead and tell us how that Bigfoot or werewolf drowned, and then hear the world go breathless when your true story comes around. You'll hear the crazy